This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 62nd in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I am pleased to have with me today Halvar Flake. Hello, Halvar.
Hello.
Halvar Flake, a.k.a. Thomas Dullion, works for Google. For many years prior to getting a, quote, real job, Halvar ran Zynamics as an independent researcher and consultant focused on reverse engineering and vulnerability discovery. Halvar is a popular conference speaker who's spoken at RSA, Black Hat, CanSec West, and other venues. He's taught classes on code analysis, reverse engineering, and vulnerability analysis for ISVs and governments. Halvar now lives in Switzerland and blogs at addxorroll.blogspot.com. So thanks for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
And congratulations on the purchase of Zynamics by Google. Can you describe how Zynamics sort of began and evolved and, you know, where things stand, what led to Google's interest and so on?
All right. Well, I can definitely talk about the beginnings of Zynamics. Many years ago, Microsoft had started putting out patches without disclosing the full details of what they were doing. And I, back then, was in a situation where I was really interested in what the security vulnerabilities underneath a particular patch were. Mm-hmm. So back in 2004, I think I wrote, or might have been late 2003, I started experimenting with comparing executables by comparing not the bytes mm-hmm. or the byte sequence, but their flow graph structure. And I wrote the first prototype for Bindiff, as far as I remember, in 2004, and then started selling it. And, well, truth of the matter is, if you sell a piece of software and you're just one person, people want source code, escrow, and so forth. As if you're actually an incorporated company, then people don't ask the same sort of questions.
Isn't that funny?
So, yeah. So I started a small German limited, which was originally operating under the name of Sabre Security. And, then we started selling Bindiff, and we launched a second product, not much thereafter, called Benavi. And things took on from there. Eventually, we got into a bit of a trademark dispute with a large travel agency that owned a trademark for the use of the word Sabre for delivering services over the internet.
Right.
And we decided that we don't want to, compete with somebody whose legal department is 50 to 60 times our company size. And at that point we decided to rename to Zynamics, which goes to show that not all democratic choices or not all democratic ways of choosing names end up in a good name.
So Bindiff is an important product, and I think it would be helpful to explain just a little bit more technically exactly how it does what it does.
All right, so the real problem when you compare two executables is that these two executables might have been derived from the same source code, but they will usually be created by vastly different build environments, which means you'll have different compilers, you'll have different compiler versions, you might have slightly different versions of the source code, and so forth. And all these things have a cascading effect where the final binary will look more different, like quite different from the other binary, just due to these changes in the build environment. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to patch diffing, at least in Microsoft's case, it's not all that bad nowadays because the build environment doesn't change much between two updates. Back in the days when we wrote Bindiff, though, the release binaries from Microsoft were optimized in a particular way, and the patches were not, and this screwed up a lot of the standard ways of comparing executables. Mm-hmm. So the trick with Bindiff really is that we try to disregard the actual bytecode as long as possible. And what we do is we create flow graphs for every function in the executable and a big graph called the call graph, which relates all the functions to each other in the executable. Mm-hmm. And then we try to compare the executables based on these graphs, which in math speak means we're trying to compute an approximate maximum graph homomorphism, which essentially says, let's try to find those chunks of the graph that are structurally identical. Mm-hmm. and then just map them to each other. And the advantage of this is that a lot of the small changes introduced by compiler optimizations and so forth disappear. So you have a lot less noise in the matching, and you can associate pieces of code that don't immediately look obviously similar through their structural properties.
Mm-hmm. And so this allows you to identify places where the patch has changed the executable in interesting ways, and then focus in on what the original vulnerability is, I suppose.
Correct. It also allows you to do other things. So the original use case was, hey, let's see what has changed between these two executables and disregard everything that is a compiler artifact. Mm-hmm. But later on, we found out that you can do many other things. For example, if you are reverse engineering a piece of software and you see a string that indicates the particular version of, let's say, OpenSSL or any other large open source library has been linked into the disassembly, mm-hmm. you can then use BINDIF's algorithms to compare your executable against a version of that library that has been compiled with debug symbols. And then you can pull that information from the version with debug symbols into your disassembly.
Oh, very nice.
And this just saves countless hours of work because, well, you get all those names more or less automatically.
Yeah, the unstripper.
Yeah. And another advantage is that you can pull information from one disassembly into another disassembly. So let's say you're analyzing two variants of the same malware. You can disassemble one malware, comment it all, and then you've got a new version of the malware. Mm-hmm. And for those parts that didn't change much, BINDIF can pull all your comments, all your names, and all the work that you put into the disassembly mm-hmm. over to the new executable.
Giving you a nice running start.
Yeah.
So I assume, based on our conversation right at the moment, that you must be very psyched to be getting back to doing more hands-on engineering and less sort of startup tending.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, realistically, the things that Google can offer us, and especially, well, the one thing that Google can offer me that Dynamics couldn't, well, there's many things that Google can offer that Dynamics couldn't offer, but the most important thing that Google can offer me that Dynamics couldn't offer was relieving me of the business side of things.
Yeah,
right?
Freeing up your time.
Allowing me to focus on what I do well, which is engineering and research, and I'm really happy about that.
That's very cool. So we discussed a bunch of your work and ideas in the book Exploiting Software, so thanks for that. I appreciate that. Do you believe, as I do, that security researchers and bad guys are making better use of classic code understanding tools like decompilers and disassemblers than people who build code for a living?
I'm not sure whether I would necessarily agree. I think the focus of these tools is quite different. Mm-hmm. Realistically, if you look at the state of reverse engineering tools, and if you look at the state of engineering tools, I think engineering tools are far more advanced than the reverse engineering tools. And there's simple economics that dictate this, because there's many people writing code for money. There's a comparatively small number of people that reverse engineer code for money.
Yep.
And as such, it's much easier to get resources for development tools than for reverse engineering tools.
Mm-hmm.
So
I see what you mean there. I agree with that. But the question that it comes to my mind is, some of these reverse engineering tools are very useful for code understanding in the first place. And yet, the people who build code for a living don't, generally speaking, make use of that technology.
Well, I think most people that write code for a living are too fascinated by the creative process of creating something that runs to actually do the sort of security analysis, detail understanding that security reviewers do.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked a lot with, well, at Dynamics we were in the amusing situation that we had both the development side and the code analysis side of the house, right? So we were developing tools, but we were developing tools for people that need to understand other software.
Yeah, so you can run it on yourself.
Yeah. So one of the devs that is in my team, and he's a great dev, he always joked that security review is literally the job that nobody that actually likes programming wants to do. Because if you like programming, you like creating stuff, and you like seeing stuff run. Whereas security review is looking at those few corner cases where things don't run. So I think the reason why developers make less use of the specialized tools for code understanding that have been built on the code or on the security review side is that it's really just not so important for them. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, for a developer, he wants to see his product run. He wants his product to see like improve people's lives and so forth. The incentive isn't quite the same. Whereas the security reviewer, he doesn't really care about the software whatsoever. He cares about the moment where he subverts that software.
Right.
So I think it's really more of a mentality issue than anything else.
So let's talk about reversing a little bit. When it comes to reversing, in your mind, what's more powerful, static analysis or dynamic analysis?
I don't think
it's actually a trick
answer.
Question.
I don't think there's a good answer for it, and it depends really on the situation.
Yeah.
When I was much younger, I used to play basketball, and the coach would always correct people's shot techniques, but also there was one golden rule, and the golden rule was whoever scores is right.
Right.
And I think that very much applies to code analysis in all sorts of ways.
That's a very interesting way of putting it. I like that.
Yeah, well, to be honest, one thing that I do appreciate about the security community is that we've got a very, very simple truth test, meaning does it find relevant bugs or does it not find relevant bugs?
Mm-hmm.
And having this truth test in the end keeps the industry, or not the industry, but keeps research honest. Because you can't argue your way out of trouble when you say, oh, my stuff is good, but it doesn't find X, Y, and Z.
Right.
Anyhow, so from the technical point of view, dynamic analysis often makes a lot of things much easier that are really hard to do or undecidable in static analysis.
Mm-hmm.
But you pay a price for this, which is like vastly reduced coverage, right? So I'm not a fan of an either-or distinction on dynamic or static. I'm a huge fan of use dynamic wherever possible to augment and improve on static, and vice versa. So I really think there's a it's not a binary choice to be made.
It's a nice co-evolutionary pattern if you think about it. The thing that strikes me these days, I've been looking for bugs for a trillion years, just like you, is that we find more bugs than we fix, regardless of the method that we use to find them. So, you know, there are a lot of people that argue over static versus dynamic, which is why I ask you that. But in the end, I think really the most important thing to emphasize these days is we just got to fix the stuff that we're finding. And sometimes, I guess, one method or the other might be more helpful to the person who has to fix the problems that the security people are finding.
Well, we all know how difficult it is to... one thing that people underestimate is the difficulty of diagnosing from a crash of what the root cause of the actual crash is, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is, I guess, one of the things where fuzzing can be... can have an interesting effect, where you might get 25,000 really different looking crashes, all for the underlying root cause, which you've got no way of figuring out.
Right.
So.
Right. We'll be right back after this message. If you like what you're hearing on Silver Bullet, you might check out my monthly security column on InformIT. I've collected all the columns I've written over the last 5 years on my website at sigil.com/GEM, or you can do a quick search under security at InformIT. Thanks for listening. So much of your work focuses on finding and leveraging bugs, kind of implementation defects. What do you think we can do to find flaws or architectural defects?
Whew. Right. I don't think we have many good ways of doing so, because in order to find architectural defects, we would first have to have a clear understanding of what we want from an architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in textbook software engineering, there's a full list of requirements from like that you have of a piece of software before you start writing it. Reality isn't like this. So... Well, I mean, reality is that there's much less architecture in the world than people would like to make themselves believe, right?
Yeah, I agree with that.
The one thing that is, well, in general, whenever you, like, you might have a Porsche car in your garage and it might run beautifully, but unless you work in car engineering, you won't realize all the engineering trade-offs that have to be made for getting that thing to run and getting it to run in the way that it's running at that price. And you won't realize how messy a process even engineering a car is. Now, software is not much better. So trying to understand or having tools to improve the finding of architectural flaws, I mean, it boils down to understanding again, right?
Yep.
And the sad truth of the matter is people want to avoid understanding at all costs.
I think that's true, especially Americans.
Well, I don't think it's really really restricted to citizenship or passports you're carrying. I think some people are better at pretending that they know when they don't. But Mark Dowd, has a brilliant quote where he says, "It never ceases to astonish him how much effort people will put into not understanding something." And when we're speaking about tools that help uncover architectural flaws, we're really speaking about tools that make the process of understanding something large and complicated less painful and more more time efficient.
Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, one of the problems is the formality of architectural descriptions is not at all the same as the formality in a source code description of a program.
Which is, again, it's so easy to mistake the map for the territory when it comes to software review. I mean, all the folks that try to work on implementation details really just exploit the difference between the map and the territory.
Yep. So I want to switch gears a little bit. I agree 100% with you that the disclosure debate is really stupid. But I wonder what your feelings are about alerting vendors and others when a new vulnerability is discovered.
Well, my personal feelings are, now, before Google bought Dynamics and so forth, I would occasionally discover flaws.
Mm-hmm.
I would not report them to vendors for exactly one reason, which is I don't have the time to deal with vendors. Because my experience my experience might have been forged in a different time.
Yeah.
But my experiences in the early 2000s was, you find a bug, and now you notify the vendor, and all of a sudden, the first thing you'll get is you'll get a reply from the legal department threatening you. You'll then, if you're lucky, eventually get somebody with development experience that wants you to spend a couple of days of unpaid time explaining the bug to them.
Exactly, yep.
And so forth and so forth.
Sort of free consulting.
And so in the optimum case, you're going to spend 3 days of your life helping somebody else do their job and probably not even get as much as a warm handshake for it. In the worst case scenario, people will start throwing the legal textbook at you or have the lawyers write threatening letters and so forth. So really, from my perspective, there was no point and incentive to ever do this.
I think I think things have improved somewhat for some of the vendors. You know, we find problems all the time in the field, and we crypt them up in the keys of the certs, and we send them directly to the product groups, and they do a pretty decent job fixing them. Sometimes they ask for more info, but often when we're finding a problem, we're working for a customer, so we've already written the stuff up in a pretty easy to package way. I guess that makes it a little bit easier.
Oh, definitely. And I think there's a big change in attitude as well. I mean, to a certain extent, you can argue that all these bug bounty programs at least create some incentive to sit down and document things. And
I still think they're a poor excuse for not paying a real QA staff.
Well, they are. I mean, but at least what I can say about my current employer is that even though they've got a bug bounty program for Chrome, it's not that they don't have internal reviews.
Yeah, right. That's true.
Yeah, so I guess my entire point is I think if you make the process of submitting issues convenient and fun, then you've got a decent shot at getting people to submit stuff to you.
Yep.
But if you make it inconvenient and hasslesome, then I guess you can't complain about them not giving you the bugs.
Yep. All right, now something slightly different. You've spent some time poking around Zeus and its, you know, huge pile of variants. In your view, is malware getting more complex, or is it about the same as it ever was?
It's definitely not the same as it ever was. I mean, we're really speaking about, like, if we go 10 years back in time, we're speaking about a significant growth in the magnitude and sophistication of the malware.
Yeah, I mean, Slammer and Code Red and IMDA, pretty easy.
Yeah, and even if we're speaking about, like, we're speaking about stones, we're speaking about, well, we're speaking about file infectors, which I have to admit had very, very sophisticated polymorphic engines. Mm-hmm. But it's the malware thing has moved from what started out as really interesting assembly experiments on writing weird code to proper software dev. Mm-hmm. I mean, malware nowadays, if you read the code, it's like, okay, they have a UML diagram on a wall somewhere or something.
Somebody actually designed it, right? It wasn't just whacked together.
And they've got a release schedule, and they've got a feature roadmap, and it's literally just like software development.
I think that's true. Well, I mean, talk about Stuxnet a little bit. That shows a fair amount of sort of engineering preparation before it was put together.
Well, both on the good and on the bad side. I mean, there were parts of Stuxnet where you're like, okay, now clearly they had one person with a lot of clout drafting the design, and then he delegated some of the code to people with a little bit less of the clout.
That's true. So, yeah, I think there was a pretty big discrepancy between the delivery vehicle and the payload in Stuxnet in particular.
Well, I think that's really what you get when you've got a large organization. Mm. And Stuxnet was built by a non-trivial sized team. And it's really difficult to get 10 really bright people, like insanely bright people, to work on one thing. So what you usually do is you get 3 or 4 of them, and then you fill up with slightly less bright people.
And you end up with what you get. So now for some politics. You were denied entry into the U.S. in 2007 when you were supposed to teach at Black Hat, which was very silly. But are you still on some kind of government list? How has that sort of, you know, unfolded over the last 4 years?
Well, really what happened back then is there was a huge misunderstanding in relation to my immigration status.
And who was paying who?
Immigration person at the border decided that me going to Black Hat and giving lectures at Black Hat and Black Hat being a for-profit and so forth, this would all require an H-1B visa, and they rejected me entry based on this. Now, we can argue back and forth about what exactly would have been the right way, but to a certain extent, there is an interpretation of the regulation of the law where what they did was completely the right thing.
Yeah, it's just a bureaucracy, a sort of a faceless bureaucracy you grind up against.
So clearly, whenever you pass the border, or whenever I get to the border nowadays, I like they pull up my data and they ask me whether like what happened back then. And for about a year and a half or 2 years thereafter, there would be a lot of questions and quite in-depth questions, and I would be singled out of the line and so forth.
Right.
But after a certain number of iterations where they've asked me questions and decided that I'm not lying.
Yeah.
They wave you through fairly quickly. So it's a very pain-free process.
That's good to hear that the bureaucracy can self-correct eventually.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think they've got... It might be economics. They've got limited resources, and they can't...
They have real immigration problems to deal with instead of pretend ones. Yep. So I've had some funny run-ins with the Canadian border. But I don't have time to talk about those now. So around RSA this year, I had the pleasure of rereading all the email that I sent to Greg Hoglund using the HB Gary Q on a Russian server, which was amusing, to say the least. What are your thoughts on the anonymous versus HB Gary situation, if any?
I think it shows that it's really difficult to keep your stuff secure if you're not paying very close attention to all parts of your infrastructure.
Yep.
I think it shows very, very clearly that transitivity kills the cat.
That's nicely stated. I like that.
I mean, literally, transitivity of trust is always what kills things in the real world, right? We all talk about OODEs, but in the end, OODEs are getting your foot into the door, and then you escalate privileges transitively.
Yep. Well, I think that, you know, people like Fred Schneider in previous iterations of this podcast have talked about the future of security issues writ large. And Fred's belief, and I think I agree with him, is that once we get done dealing with architectural flaws, which, as you just pointed out, we have a long way to go, the next thing is going to be trust enclaves. And stuff like trust transitivity will be the core of what we have to figure out how to work on.
The question really is how quickly you end up putting restrictions on the on innovation in this way. I like to think about information as currency.
Yep.
And I mean, there's good reasons why you usually don't have capital controls when you run markets, just because you don't necessarily want to restrict the flow of money across borders. Mm-hmm, or, mm-hmm. And whereas some arguments can be made for restricting the flow of money in some situations, in most situations it's not the right thing. And I think similarly with information, I think there's always a trade-off of productivity, innovation, and if you restrict flow of information too much, you run the risk of, well, denying the attacker your information, but your organization is going to wither and die anyhow because you're strangling yourself.
Right, yep.
So that's going to be an interesting and very hard problem to deal with. How do you restrict access to information while at the same time providing information? The intelligence community is probably running into
that. That's exactly what I was going to say. They're all over that right now. You know, if you think about WikiLeaks and the idea of de-siloing after 9/11 in the U.S. intelligence community, the idea was we're going to allow lots of people more information so that they can, quote, connect the dots. And then, you know, all of a sudden we're surprised when some private goes rogue and does something very silly. So
there you go.
It's a tough one. One last question. Are you concerned about the U.S. obsession with cyber war over there on your side of the pond?
Well, no. No, I think it might be... Well, I'm not concerned with U.S. Focus on cyber war at all. I think it is... well, I'm not sure what sort of hype is being blown these days, but generally speaking, computer attacks are a valid component of espionage these days, mm-hmm. which is just a reality, and it's very difficult to deny that computers and espionage go together these days, or intelligence and computers, whatever you want to call it. And I think it's a good thing that these things are discussed openly. Like in general, I think it's much healthier if military officials go on the record and say, yes, we do this, mm-hmm. instead of standing up and denying that they are even getting close to that stuff.
Yep.
Also because I think that in a healthy democracy, the public is informed about what the military is doing. So generally, I think an open discussion of the topics is a good and healthy thing.
Very nice.
So, yeah.
I have a 16-year-old who likes to listen to German thrash metal, which is...
Oh, my.
Thanks a lot for that. What kind of music are you listening to these days, and what's your favorite?
Oh, my. Now, generally, my taste in music is, according to my girlfriend, quite horrible. it ranges from German rap from the mid-90s, over a bunch of Argentinian tango to jazz from the 30s.
I play in a Django band. I like jazz from the 30s myself.
Yeah. It's really quite wide. I guess it's very difficult to name an individual favorite. One thing that I very much like and a band that I very much like and which is, in my opinion, very underappreciated is a band called Jency Warnick from Cologne, and they're like two Russians and a Texan dude or something like this, mm-hmm. and they mix heavy and surf punk with Russian folk music or something like
that. Wow, interesting blend.
And it's awesome. It's fun.
Cool. Well, thanks for your time today.
All right. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Inform IT. The March-April issue of IEEE S&P features articles on usability. The interview department reprises our conversation with David Rice, who's now CSO of Apple. That's episode 46. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.